PPI.org.
Joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl and Amber Johnson are my research women. Charlene Dahl's in the studio tonight. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everybody.
Tonight, we have an awesome guest with us, and that is Abby Taylor. Abby Taylor is a visually impaired author, and she will be talking about two of her books. Abby is a registered music therapist and has worked with senior citizens in nursing homes and other facilities. And she also facilitated a support group for blind and visually impaired adults, taught Braille, and served on the advisory board to a trust fund used to purchase adaptive equipment for people who are blind and visually impaired. She is the author of 5 books, 2 novels, 2 poetry collections, and a memoir. Abby is currently the president of Behind Our Eyes, an organization of with disability writers, and is also involved in several other local, state, and national writing groups. And good evening, Abby.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being on. All right. Well, I'm sorry, you must be subjected to the thing I always ask all of my authors. How in the world did you ever decide you wanted to be a writer? And when did you decide this?
Well, I decided back, I think, in the earlier part of this century. As you said earlier, I actually was a registered music therapist. I'm no longer registered. No, I'm not, because I don't practice music therapy anymore. I'm specifically a writer now. But back in 2000, when I was working in a nursing home, I decided, took it up as a hobby. And I just decided that although the music therapy was rewarding, I actually felt like I needed a career change. And so I did more and more writing on the side, and it was hard because I was working 40-hour weeks, and it was difficult trying to find time to write. But finally, in 2005, when I married my late husband, Bill, he persuaded me to quit the day job and just write full-time, which is what I wanted to do, and that's what I did.
Well, that's interesting just because, you know, usually you hear this story about somebody who was inspired by their English teacher or whatever, you know, when they were very young. But you kind of came in, not that you're old, but you came into it later in life. And I feel sometimes that happens less often, but I don't know, seems to be working for you.
Yeah, I think you're right. But now that I think of it, looking back, I did like to write when I was younger, but then I got into other things, and I wish now that perhaps I had pursued writing as a career when I was younger. But, you know, what's done is done, and, you know, shoulda, coulda, woulda, don't do any gooda is my motto now. So I just keep on keeping on and do what I can later in life.
So tell me about Behind Our Eyes.
Behind Our Eyes is an organization of disabled authors. We are scattered across the country. We write fiction, poetry, nonfiction. Our group meets twice a month for discussions. We have guest speakers sometimes. We do critique sessions. We have roundtable discussions on particular topics. We recently did one on blogging. We also produce an online magazine called Magnets and Ladders, which is produced twice a year. We have published 2 anthologies of our work, and we're currently working on a 3rd one.
Cool. So the anthology is just kind of a compilation of everyone's pieces?
Yes. Yeah, it's a compilation of stories, poems, and essays by our members. Now, the first anthology, we opened it up to anybody, but the last two are just a work by our members. Now, Magnets and Ladders is also open to anybody. Anybody can submit to that.
So it sounds like that organization is kind of a sounding board. Kind of, you can kind of compare each other's writing and give yourselves feedback.
Right, right.
How many members are in it?
We have, I'd say, at least 60 members.
And where are you guys located?
Well, like I say, we're scattered across the country. Our home base is in Maine, because that's where one of our presidents was located, and that's where we are 501c3 mm-hmm. corporation, so that's where we kind of pay the taxes there in
right.
Maine. But otherwise, like I say, we're just all over the country, and there's even a couple people overseas.
Excellent. Wow. So what do you have to do to get into Behind Our Eyes?
Well, you have to be disabled, but you would simply go to the website at Behind Our Eyes, BehindOurEyes.org, and complete the membership form. And then you'll be contacted, and there is an email list that you'll need to subscribe to, because that's the only way you'll know what's going on in our groups. When you fill out that form, you'll be contacted about subscribing to the list. And once you do that, then you'll be, contacted with instructions on how to access the phone calls. And of course, when meetings are announced on our list, usually the phone numbers for the meeting is given. We meet via phone conference, and the number is given provided on the list for each meeting when the meeting is announced.
Do you have to have published anything or be a...
No,
okay.
Absolutely not. The membership form does ask you that, but that's just, that's just so that we know that, it's not some Tom, Dick, and Harry who is really not an author, trying to get in. But no, you don't need to be published at all. You can just write for the heck of it if you want, but no, you don't need to be published.
Are most people published that are in the group?
Yes, I think, in some way, shape, or form. I've got 5 books. We've got others who just have work published in magazines. And then we just have some who haven't really published anything yet, but are working on it. So we work with all levels of writers.
Ah, excellent. Do you ever have any writers' workshops where you kind of teach different facets of writing or how to get better?
We have had classes by outside people who aren't members of our group. We've had writers come in and teach workshops. Some of them, we once had a poet years ago that taught a class that met over a period of 8 or 9 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who just come in and do maybe 1-day workshops. So we do a variety of different activities.
So, Abby, if it's okay with you, I think I'd like to start with my ideal partner, because it's just...
Sure.
It was such a dramatic book. First of all, I want to say that you have my admiration as a caregiver. I don't know...
Thank you.
...that I would ever be able to do that. And it'll be interesting, when people hear it, I think it's a good story. But talk a little bit about that book and why you decided to write it.
Well, I started writing the book after my late husband's death. He passed away in 2012, and in October 2012, and I think in January of 2013 that I started writing the book. And I had to put it aside after about a month or so because it was getting too emotional. But I'm glad I started it when I did, because I was able to then get all the details down about my caregiving, learning how to transfer him and get him dressed and that sort of thing, because it was another year or so before I was able to get back to it. And of course, by that time, then all the my memory might not have been as sharp. So, but anyway, it was finished then, I think maybe 2014 or 2015, and then it was published in 2016.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you about a piece that's in the book. It's at the very beginning, and I found it interesting. If you like, if you're okay, I'd like to just read it a little bit for the listeners.
Sure,
It's "What is Love? Being warmed from within or by another, having someone with whom to share dreams, a soothing voice that comforts you, gentle hands that soothe life's hardships, strong arms that hold you close, lips that bring you pleasure. Love is a heart that's yours forever." And so can you tell me where you got that, or what inspired you to write that?
Well, was actually a poem. Bill wasn't much of a poet, but I wrote a poem asking what it was like to be loved, because when he proposed to me, I had not had any experience in that department. Even mm-hmm. though I was in my mid-40s, I hadn't been married before. I hadn't even been in love before. So I didn't know what to expect, and I didn't know how I should feel or what it was like. And so I wrote this poem, and I emailed it to him. And then he wrote me a response and emailed it back to me. At the time, he was living in Fowler, Colorado, and I was living here in Sheridan, Wyoming. Well, there was a poetry workshop by a singer-songwriter where he would take poems and make them into songs. And mm-hmm. so I put the poem together. I kind of combined, well, actually, it was mostly his thoughts on what it's like to be loved. I made that into a poem and submitted that to him, and he made it into a song that he sang at our wedding. And so that's how that poem came about.
Interesting. I want to stay on that for a minute, because reading that book, you had a very, what I would consider a not normal courtship. You had a very unusual courtship. And so you talk about being very apprehensive about marriage, kind of going back and forth. And I think a lot of people are. I don't think that's anything unusual, but I think it's unusual. I think it's very real that you were like that because of the courtship that you have had. Would you talk a little bit about that so people know?
Yes. Well, what was unusual about it, for 2 years, it was a long-distance relationship. We emailed each other at least once a day, sometimes twice, three times, depending on when we checked our email, how often we checked our email, that is. We've talked on the phone at least maybe once a week. He made tapes of music he downloaded from the Internet and mailed them to me. And so we went like this. This started, I believe, in 2003. And during that time, I was working on my first book, We Shall Overcome, and I emailed him chapters, and he sent me feedback. And so we've been corresponding like this for about 2 years. Finally, in January of 2005, all of a sudden, out of the blue, I get this Braille letter in the mail. Let me just back up for a minute. Bill was totally blind, and of course, I have a visual impairment. I have some vision. But Bill was totally blind. So he sent me this Braille letter in the mail in January of 2005 asking me to marry him. And this is quite unexpected because I thought he just wanted to be friends. Turns out he had been working up the nerve to propose to me for 6 months prior to that. And he finally did. And like I said, it was quite a shock. And so naturally, I had these misgivings at first. I didn't mm-hmm. know what to think or feel because I had no idea from the get-go. If he told me 6 months ago that he had feelings for me, it might have been easier for me to deal with. But at that moment, it was like a tsunami. And, of course, at that time, I remember there was a tsunami somewhere overseas somewhere that I was hearing about on the news. And I thought, oh, well, I've got my own personal tsunami right here. I can't be worried about that. The moment. So naturally, and so it took me a while, but by the time he wanted to come and see me in Sheridan, because when I received his letter, I thought he wanted me to move to Fowler, Colorado, and that was another shocker, because the idea, I've been living in Sheridan for years, and the idea of starting over in a new community was not, was quite daunting to me, and I really didn't know if I wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was talking to my father about this, and he said, well, why don't you spend some time with him in Fowler and see if you'd like being with him and if you'd like the town. And so when he called me after I received the letter, I said, can I maybe come down and see you this summer and see if maybe, you know, I'd like living with you, and, you know, like being in the town and living there. I mean, I'd only been there a couple times because my father and I had visited him on our way to and from New Mexico, where we, where my brother and his family lived at the time. And so I hadn't really been to Fowler that much. So I didn't know that much about the town, except it was small. So when I asked him this, he said, well, actually, I'm thinking of moving to Sheridan. And so that threw a whole new light on it. I mean, I could get my head around marrying him if he was here in town and I didn't have to move.
Right.
Because it was bad enough that I had to, do I want to marry him? Do I want to move to Fowler, Colorado? I didn't think I wanted to do that. So, and so he agreed to come and see me. He didn't want to wait till summer. And so I had 2 months to kind of get my head around this. I mean, my grandmother said, he's got it bad for you. He came, and he wasn't even researching houses. We could live in here in Sheridan. It was just amazing. But anyway, he came here in March, and we arranged to have dinner with some friends, and that was where he would officially propose to me. And I don't know how or why, but by that time, he'd only been with me a few days in my apartment. And by that time, I knew that I wanted to spend my lifetime loving him. So I said yes.
I think it's interesting when people talk about, you know, people who are over, let's just say over 40, when they talk about long distance
right.
relationships, is so different than today's long distance relationship where you can Skype and FaceTime and look at each other and,
yes.
you know, really talk and have unlimited long distance where not too terribly long ago, that just wasn't how it worked. So it was a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
I'd like to fast forward a little bit to your, once you guys get married, and really you were only married, I mean, months until, you know, the tragedy, sad part of
yes.
this happened.
Yes.
And I admired you with the idea of, that you just stuck in there. You know,
mm-hmm.
a handful of months isn't very long for anybody.
Right.
And
right.
it's not, it is very common for someone to say, I'm sorry, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. And, but
well,
you so did it. And what made you want to keep doing it? And instead of just saying, you just got to go to the nursing home and I'll visit you or wherever.
Well, you know, I could have done that, but, you know, he would have been happier at home with me. And, frankly, it just never occurred to me to walk away. That was never an option. The idea never even popped into my head. We, even though we didn't say it at our wedding ceremony in September, we were married for better or for worse. And if that meant caring for him at home, then that's what I would do. Now, of course, we thought that maybe he might walk again after, you know, some therapy, and so that I wouldn't having to be caring for him full time, you know, all permanently. But then after, you know, in January then of 2000, he came home in September of 2006. And then in January of 2007, he suffered a second stroke that wasn't severe, but it was enough to set him back, and he still continued outpatient therapy after he came home from the nursing home the second time. But in August of that year, they just gave up on him because he wasn't making any progress. And unfortunately, Medicare does not cover any kind of maintenance therapy to keep you at the level where you are. You have to show some progress in order for them to cover it. So they just basically gave up on him. And so, at that time, you know, just putting him in the nursing home and saying, I'll come see you every day, I didn't even occur to me. You know, because by that time I'd gotten used to it. You know, we'd gotten into a routine. And so I just resigned myself to being his permanent caregiver. And I did that until September of 2012, when he had been declining over the summer, and he was getting too weak for me to care for him at home. And we brought in a physical therapist to see what could be done. And he said, you know, it's just not safe for you two to be at home together anymore. And so that's when I had to move into a nursing home. And fortunately, he was okay with it. He wasn't angry at me or bitter. He just accepted it. He didn't like it, but he just accepted it. And, you know, we moved on as best we could. And I had hoped to get him into a place called Greenhouse, which is a facility where they call their residents elders, and they're in cottages of 12 people, and each person has his or her own room, and there's a much smaller staff to elder ratio, so the elders get more attention. Mm-hmm. And he could have had his computer and his recliner and everything in that room. I'd hoped to get him into that facility, but unfortunately they had a 6-month waiting list for Medicare, so I had to move him to the nursing home where I'd worked for 15 years and where he'd been going for respite care every once in a while when I had to be out of town for one reason or another. And so we moved him there with the stipulation that when a room became available at Greenhouse, I would move him there. Well, a month later, he was gone. He had was going even more downhill after that. He had, you know, he lost weight. He was losing strength. He needed help eating. And he finally passed in October of 2012.
So I think you probably will agree that, you know, when you're a partner and you first start out, you have a certain role. And when you become a caregiver, like everyone's a caregiver to each other to a certain extent, right? Somebody might do X amount for somebody else because they have a harder time, or somebody would do the other things for the other person that has a harder time doing something else. But
right,
I think
right.
If you're a full-time caregiver for everything, pretty much, that really weighs on the relationship. And I think it can be blurring for the lines of partnership and caregiver. How did you separate that? How did you keep that still okay?
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that we loved each other. I mean, we had our rocky roads. Mm-hmm. It wasn't always easy. But, you know, as long as we had each other and we loved each other, we were both willing to make it work. And we did for at least 6 years.
Do you think there were stages that you went through that helped you kind of, that you would kind of set different expectations or boundaries or whatever that helped you accept going into this, that you were?
Well, during the first year of this, after he came home from the nursing home, mm-hmm. in September of 2006, like I said, we thought that he would eventually get back on his feet. We were optimistic, although by the time he came home, the physical therapy department and the speech therapist had given up on him because he'd reached plateau. And so the occupational therapist was just working with him on maintaining what strength he had and getting us ready to transition home. But I was thinking that I wouldn't be doing this, you know, all the time. So that I was in kind of a denial, I guess you'd call it a denial stage. Mm-hmm. But then after he suffered a second stroke in January, and then in August when he came home from physical therapy one day and said, they've given up on me, I'm not going to walk. And we both held each other and we cried a little bit, and then I said, okay, you know, we'll just keep on keeping on, and you know, it is what it is. And that's basically how it worked.
Well, it's an amazing story, and I feel like you were in some ways lucky or fortunate, let's use that one, because there were things that you were able to apply to help you get finances to help with some accessibility and things like that, where not everyone gets to do that. Certainly that played into helping you be a better caregiver.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had some excellent services in the state and locally. We had a state agency that provided some funding, and we had a local, the senior center had a local in-home health care program that provided aides to come and give him a shower 3 days a week and clean our house. And so we, and I would not have been able to do any of this without the support.
Do you feel like you got a lot of support from friends and family during this time?
Well, not as much as from the agencies they worked with. I mean, they were helpful as they could be, but, you know, I don't know. I, like my father, for example, I mean, he was helpful, and he actually did, you know, he figured out how to transfer Bill into his car so we could drive him places. But I just, I had nobody there that I could talk to when I just felt overwhelmed, you know, when he, like the day Bill had his second stroke, we had gone to the senior center for lunch, and he was kind of lethargic that day. And then after lunch, we had our monthly visually impaired person support group meeting that I was facilitating at the time. And he just fell asleep. He slept through the whole thing. And I got him home, and he was so weak, and I didn't know what to think. I called his doctor, and I remember wishing I had somebody I could just call and just vent. And who just listen, you know, and I didn't really have any of that. But, you know, it worked. We made it work. That was all we could do.
Did you feel like, I mean, how did you balance your own needs?
Well, that was tricky. You know, there were times when I had to tell him, honey, I'm in the middle of something. I'll be with you as soon as I can, you know. But of course, if he had to go to the bathroom, sometimes there were a lot of times if I didn't get there quickly enough, we would end up with wet pants. So, but other times, you know, I tell him, well, honey, if he just wanted to, you know, to get to his computer or something that wasn't completely urgent, I tell him, can you just wait just a few minutes? I'm right in the middle of doing because I was writing. I had two books published during that time, and so I was, you know, I was also writing, and of course he was pretty good about that because he supported me as a writer, and you know he was so proud when my first book came out, We Shall Overcome. He held it in, I got or getting the print copies, and I put one in his hands. He couldn't see it all, but he held it, and he had this, I could imagine this shit eating grin he had on his face, and he said, "My wife, the published author," you know, he was so happy. So he was always supportive, and he was willing to, you know, if it wasn't an urgent need, he was going to wait a few minutes, you know, 5 or 10 minutes if I was right in the middle of something. And so it worked out.
Abby, I want to talk about, it sounded sometimes like, you know, you would have him stay in somewhere when you wanted to go off or get a break, as you said, you know, maybe you'd take a little trip. But sometimes you had some guilt. How did you deal with that?
Well, I just had to, you know, I would actually, you know, tell him, I'd say, honey, I'm really sorry that I really want to go to this. It was usually for writers' conferences. And of course, like I said earlier, he was happy about me writing. And, you know, I told him and said, I'm sorry that I have to do this. And he said, it's okay. And I would always call him when I could. I would call the nursing home because they had phones in the rooms and they could, you know, we could talk on the phone while I was gone. And that was really the only way I could deal with the guilt.
Yeah. Do you have any, you know, good advice? I mean, obviously there are people out there who are caregivers and who have probably, fortunately for them, maybe been married or with their person longer than you had. So they could form a good attachment, you know,
right.
That's what I think was so spectacular is that really you had such little time for, you know, the quote normal life as you knew it, stepping into it, and then things drastically changed.
Right.
And that, I think a lot of people would not have stayed with that. But you did. So do you have any advice for people who are going through the same thing?
Well, if you can find a support group for caregivers, I think that would be helpful because I did that for a while. The senior center has one, and it still has one now and had one back then. And I went to their meetings, and it did help. If you can find a support group for other caregivers, also, you know, local senior centers oftentimes have respite care, or they have a help at home, help in-home health care programs where people can come in and, you know, help with, you know, bathing, dressing, that kind of thing. So, you don't have to do it alone. Fine, there are resources out there for help with this sort of thing. So check into that and don't try to do it all by yourself, because it's not possible.
What's something that you did to help keep your mental state healthy?
I think the writing helped. During that time, I wrote a lot of poems about my experiences, and most of them are in my collection, How to Build a Better Mousetrap, Recollections and Reflections of Family Caregiving, a Caregiver. And writing is very cathartic for me. And of course, I had a monthly poetry group meeting. We call it Third Thursday Poets, and I would always joke if I brought in a poem for critique that was about my experience, I'd say, okay, I know another caregiver poem, you know, I'm sorry, but and of course they were always very nice and helpful, and you know, they were very supportive, but I did write a lot of poems about that, and my ideal partner, the book, was also a cathartic experience for me after the fact. It helped me grieve and move on.
You use the term how to build a better mousetrap, and that's something you kind of used throughout the book. Talk a little bit about how that came about.
Well, we had a problem with one of the aides that was giving Bill his showers, had a problem. She was having some back pain, and she thought that it might be attributed to her lifting Bill from the bed to the commode. Before in the bedroom, before wheeling him into the shower. And so our caseworker came in and observed her, and she said, you know, I really don't know how to build a better mousetrap. I think we better get a physical therapist in here to see what he thinks. And I thought, okay, we don't have a solution to this problem, but I've got a great title for a poetry book. And I just happened to be working on a collection of poems at the time and about my caregiving experiences, which happened to be that book, and that's how the title came about.
Excellent. Well, what did you take away from being a caregiver? That's a pretty huge task for anybody to do, and
well,
I think a lot of us have done it maybe some time in our life at some point. But what did you take away?
Well, this may sound selfish, but I am not. It's been 2012, 13, 14, I have to count. It's been 6 years since he passed, but I'm still not ready to care for another human being. Or a living thing, not just a human being, but a living thing. I thought about getting a cat or a dog, you know, for some companionship, but I really don't want the responsibility, because taking care of Bill was a lot of responsibility. Because I couldn't see very well, you know, there were times when I worried, because he wouldn't always tell me if something hurt or if he had a sore somewhere. I had to rely on the aides who gave his showers to tell me if, say, if he had an ingrown toenail or a sore or some kind of skin lesion that needed to be looked at, because he wouldn't tell me and I wouldn't know. And I worried about him, you know, even when he was well, because I worried, you know, what if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? You know, what if he has dementia? What if he gets dementia? You know, I can't deal with that responsibility anymore. So I think what I've taken away is the fact that I don't want to do it again. And I know that sounds selfish, but that's kind of what it does, well, at least what it's done to me.
I'm not sure that's selfish.
As a person.
I have a lot of respect that you did it once and for not just 2 months. So it was, I thought, a very unselfish endeavor for you to take the first time. And I think that says a lot for you as a person. I'd like to move on, if it's okay, to your most recent book, which is called The Red Dress. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
I was inspired to write that after attending a memoir writing workshop, believe it or not. Now, this, The Red Dress, is a work of fiction. But when I went to this memoir writing workshop, we were asked to write about and then share what we'd written about a specific article of clothing that had some sort of significance in our lives. And one elderly woman in the group wrote about a red blouse that her mother had made for her. And when she went to college, a sorority sister apparently bullied her into giving her the red blouse. And this affected her relationship with her mother. And so I got the idea to kind of work with that, maybe put a little bit more of a twist on it so that it wouldn't be, you know, look like I was plagiarizing her story. And so that's how The Red Dress came about.
Do you see a part of yourself in each of your books?
Well, in a way, I do. Now, The Red Dress, all the characters there are cited, but my main character is a writer like me. So, yes, I think I do, you know, in all my books. Now, the poetry, I think you're right. I do see myself, a little bit of myself in all the books. Yes.
Is it ever hard for you, like my ideal partner, for example, you put a lot of yourself out there on the table there. Was that hard?
Yes, it was. And that's why after I started writing it in 2013, I needed to put it aside. But then when I was ready to deal with it again, the hard part was just, you know, deciding what should go in the book and what should not. Because there's a lot of it happened. What was relevant, what was not relevant. And, of course, some of the details, by the time I picked it up again, I couldn't remember. So I did actually have to fudge a few, like, minor things, like mm-hmm. what we had for lunch at the nursing home when we ate together, things
right.
like that, that I couldn't remember, but that I want to bring in, you know, to just show the readers our lives, not just tell.
Were you nervous first when you first started writing?
No, I wasn't. Because writing at home alone, you know, nobody's looking over your shoulder. It's not that nerve-wracking. I was nervous about whether or not people would like what I wrote when it came out. But, you know, the writing process itself didn't make me nervous.
Talk about what that feeling was when you published your first book.
Well, it was exhilarating, especially for Bill, but for me too. I mean, it was a wonder, you know, holding that book in my hand, and I had some vision so I could see the cover of it, and I could see my picture on the back cover of it. You know, I can't really describe it. There's not, you know, it's just a real sense of accomplishment when that happens.
Do you have advice to give other young writers or anybody who's just starting out?
Yes, I would suggest that one important thing is that even if you're just writing email, you're still writing. You know, you should write every day for 15, excuse me, 15 or 20 minutes. You should write something. Also, read in the genre in which you write. And I would also suggest that you get involved in local and, if possible, state writing groups. Excuse me. That's basically my advice.
What's your favorite work that you've published?
You know, I don't really have any favorites. I think all my work, I like all the work, everything that I've written so far. I don't really have any favorites.
In The Red Dress, do you have a most favorite part of the book?
Well, yes, the ending. And I really don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, I understand that one.
But I think the ending of the book is my favorite.
the character in that book, she really tries hard to appease everyone. What made you want to make her that way?
You know, that's a really good question. I haven't really thought of it that much, but she just kind of evolved that way, and I'm really, you know, that's just how it happened, and I really couldn't tell you why I wanted her that way, but that's how she came out.
Do you feel like that is any part of your personality?
Well, in a way, yes. But I keep telling myself, you know, you've heard that Ricky Nelson song, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. But when I was younger, I was trying to do that. And now when I get to feeling overwhelmed, I get to feeling depressed because I maybe not made somebody happy or, you know, upset somebody, I think, well, I do the best I can in life. And if I can't please everybody, okay, so what? I just move on.
Do you have something you're working on currently?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I recently started another novel, which was inspired by a quote I recently read by Irma Bombeck. Your grandmother pretends not to know you on Halloween. Having worked with nursing home residents suffering from dementia, I know, of course, that your grandmother may not be pretending to know you, not just on Halloween, but at any time of the year.
Ah.
And that gave me the idea to write about a grandmother who has Alzheimer's, who lives in a nursing home, who has a secret that nobody else in the family knows except her daughter. And she reveals this secret to her granddaughter. And the book then is about how this affects the family.
Do you have a title yet?
Yes, it's called Grandma Doesn't Know Me.
Ah, well, we will look forward to hearing that one and seeing that when we get that. How can people get your books?
The easiest way is to go to my website at www.abbyjohnsontaylor, A-B-B-I-E, JohnsonTaylor.com. And you will find there are pages for all of my books there. And each page has ordering links where they can get the books. They're available from Amazon and Smashwords and other online retailers. And for those who use Bookshare, they're all available on Bookshare. And We Shall Overcome and How to Build a Better Mousetrap and My Ideal Partner are available in talking book format through the Utah State Library, and regional talking book libraries should be able to access them through interlibrary loan.
So Bard should, they're on
Bard. Bard, yes. Bard.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yay. Well, can you give
me... Well, actually, no, they're not. Unfortunately, they're not on BARD.
Oh.
They're just available. Unfortunately, the Utah Library does not upload their books to BARD. That's why...
Really?
If you want it... No, they don't. And I don't know why.
Fascinating.
So you can download it from their site if you're a patron. But otherwise, you have to call your local talking book library or your regional talking book library and have them get it through interlibrary loan.
So tell me your website again, please.
Okay, it's www.abbyjohnsontaylor, abbyjohnsontaylor.com.
All right. What is your favorite part of being a writer?
The actual creating. When I get an idea and I write it down, and then I make it into something, either a poem or a story or an essay. That's my favorite part.
Who do you look up to? Like, whose stuff do you really admire or love to read?
Well, I like Danielle Steele and Debbie May Comer. I enjoy their books. However, as I've grown as a writer, I discovered that I don't really like Danielle Steele's style of providing a lot of narrative in her books. But her stories are compelling enough to keep me reading so that I just slog through the narrative.
Well, give me the title of your future book, and when do you expect it to be out?
I don't know yet. I just started writing it. I don't set a goal. Okay, I'm going to finish this by next year and then publish it the year after that, because I have other obligations with my blog and website, and other things keep me busy. And so all I can say is it'll be published when I finish it and when I feel it's ready to be published. And I can't tell you when that will be as yet. And that's really the nice thing about not being a best-selling author, you know, because you're not on a deadline. Nobody expects you to write at least one book a year. You can just take your time and do it and make sure it's good.
Ah, yes.
Not that best-selling books aren't good, but it's just I can just imagine the pressure these best-selling authors are under. And last week when I was doing a book signing, I overheard a customer telling the store owner that he thought that the author of the Jack Reacher books had lost his touch. And I got to thinking, well, yeah, that poor guy, I think Lee Child, I think is his name, you know, he's probably is pressured to publish at least one book a year, maybe more. And when you're under a deadline like that, it really quashes your creativity. I can imagine. And so it's got to be hard to be original. And, not, you know, so that's why I'm glad I'm not a best-selling author.
Is it hard for you to come up with the ideas? I mean, do they take a long time to come, or do they just kind of snap into...
They do sometimes, and then sometimes, like in the idea with Grandma Doesn't Know Me, you know, I read the quote on somebody's blog, and it just, you know, the idea just came into my head at that point. So they come unexpectedly, and then sometimes when I want ideas, they don't come. So it's serendipity is how it works, and that's how I work with it.
Abby, I want to thank you for being willing to come on and sharing your books with me. Is there any advice you want to give anybody about writing?
About writing? Well, other than what I said, you know, read books in your genre, study how others do it, participate in local writing groups, and, you know, write every day, even if it's just an email message. Or you journal if you like to journal. You know that's also counts as writing. But write, read, and network. Those are my three main bits of advice.
Thank you again for being on. We really appreciate it. Good luck with your next book.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Good night.
KPI.org.